Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Larkin, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This panel of the court today has three cases on its oral argument calendar. Excuse me. The first case set for oral argument is case number A23-0935 in the matter of the welfare of the child of FFNM. Those are initials. Counsel for appellant, I assume both of you are familiar with our protocols. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You may approach the lectern and begin. Please identify yourself at the beginning of your argument. Apologize, counsel. I think the panel is ready now.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I'm having a technology issue. If I may have just one moment. May it please the court, counsel, and good morning. My name is Brooke Beskow-Warg, and I represent appellant mother in this appeal of the order terminating her parental rights and denying mother's motion for relief from the order and a new trial. This is a default TPR case. However, it's not a typical default TPR case. It's not typical because in this case, the parent did not fail to appear for the trial. The record is clear that mother was at the hearing. It is also perhaps less typical because this is a case where mother was self-represented. Self-representation does not and cannot change how the rules are applied. Parents, whether they are represented by counsel or representing themselves, are entitled to fundamentally fair procedures in TPR proceedings. The Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure were crafted to ensure that the due process rights of parties are protected. When the rules are not followed, due process is eroded. This is especially true where the violation of the rule results in a parent losing their right to testify, present evidence, and cross-examine witnesses. The rules at issue here are Minnesota Rule of Juvenile Protection Procedure 18, and Minnesota Rule of Juvenile Protection Procedure 3804.
Now, these aren't the only rules that are at issue, right? I mean, there's rules of decorum, and your client was either unable or unwilling to follow any rules of decorum. So what actually is the district court supposed to do in those circumstances?
Sure, yes, there absolutely are rules of decorum, and the district court in this situation was presented with a difficult situation.
Kind of an understatement based on my review of the record.
Yes, Your Honor. And even and despite mother's behavior at the hearing, mother still has rights that need to be protected under statute, under the Constitution with the fundamentally fair procedures that she is entitled to, and under the Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure as well.
Counsel, what rights are you speaking of? The right to what?
The right to testify, the right to cross-examine, the right to present evidence, and also the right to participate in the proceedings more generally. Okay.
She had all those rights, And I understand that the district court initially referred to this as a default proceeding, and you're arguing it wasn't a proper default proceeding because she appeared. What I'm wondering is how Rule 3804 impacts your argument, because we have a specific rule that says the court may remove a party from a hearing based on bad behavior and continue with the hearing, which is what happened here.
That's correct, Your Honor. Rule 3804 does provide that a parent may be excluded from the hearing if they have disruptive behavior or if it is otherwise in the best interest of the child. That does not preclude a parent from necessarily participating in the proceedings, which is protected under Statute 260C-163, Subdivision 2.
So are you challenging the validity of that rule?
Of Rule 3804?
Right.
I'm not, Your Honor. The rule explicitly provides that even if a parent is excluded, the court cannot exclude the parent's counsel. This, of course, presented a tricky situation because mother is acting as her own counsel. She also still maintains the rights that she has under the statute and under the rules and under the Constitution.
But she didn't have an attorney, so
that's correct.
She's representing herself.
That is correct.
She, through her own behavior, is removed from the hearing. So as a result of her removal, she was unable to represent herself, testify, cross-examine, present evidence. But all of that stems from her removal from the hearing. So shouldn't we be asking, was that removal justified?
Your Honor, I don't believe that's necessarily the dispositive question.
Why isn't it? I mean, I note a few things. She doesn't have a constitutional right to counsel. It's
correct.
A statutory right.
Mm-hmm.
She waived it. Her arguments about whether or not that was valid, assuming for the sake of this discussion it was valid. We have case law in the criminal context where a defendant does have a constitutional right mm-hmm. to counsel and many of the same rights you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
And that case law says if a party misbehaves, the defendant can be removed. And the case law also says, well, what do you do if the defendant is pro se? Well, ideally, best practice would be to appoint standby advisory counsel. But your client doesn't have the right to standby advisory counsel. So I need you to tell me what authority says that if a district court properly removes a parent from a hearing and proceeds with the hearing under Rule 3804, mm-hmm. there's a due process violation.
Sure. And, Your Honor, I, again, would rely on the fact that due process, which, you know, the mandates of due process include the right to notice, the right to a timely hearing, the right to...
She had all those rights. She had a right to notice and an opportunity to be heard. But through her behavior, she was unable to exercise those rights. Why would we blame the district court as opposed to saying that outcome is the natural consequence of your proper removal from the hearing?
And, Your Honor, my response to that would be that the waiver of one right, in this case, the waiver of the right to be present at the hearing, is not an absolute waiver of all rights at issue in this trial.
But how can she exercise the other rights about which you're complaining if she has waived her right to be present?
Normally, in a situation where the parent is represented by counsel,
the parent isn't represented by counsel here.
That is...
So she has a right to represent herself, mm-hmm. which she requested and was granted. She has a right to present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, testify, be present, and participate at the trial, unless she behaves in a manner that warrants her removal, and the rules then allow the district court to go forward with the trial. I'm not hearing the reason that her removal, based on her behavior, does not necessarily result in the waiver of other rights that she could only exercise by being present and behaving.
I would also point to Rule 18, which is the rule under which the district court proceeded through.
Is that the default rule?
Rule 18 is the default rule.
You know what? I'm not going to go there with you because I understand that the district court said default at the point when she was in the hallway causing a ruckus with the deputies, could not physically appear in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. Once she did appear and then was removed and the trial went forward, I agree with you. I don't think it should be called a default. And it doesn't matter that the district court did, because when we review a district court's decision, we will affirm it if the district court made the right decision for the wrong reason. So even if the district court erred by saying this is a proper default proceeding, in my view, I'm not speaking for the panel, that doesn't matter, because there is another rule which more precisely fits exactly what happened here. So I would like to focus on how you get around that rule.
And that rule is 3804, just to be clear.
That's the one.
Okay. And Your Honor, Rule 3804 specifically pertains to the parents' right to be physically present at the hearing. They also have a statutory right to continue to participate in the proceedings under 260C 163 Subdivision 2.
How are they supposed to do that, though, if they've been properly absented from the hearing? I mean, the struggle that I have here is, what is the district court supposed to do in this mm-hmm. circumstance? You've got somebody who is completely disruptive, is pointedly not participating in the hearing. And so what are they supposed to do other than what the district court did here?
So the district court would have the discretion to continue the hearing. I understand that's maybe not the best option, but that would certainly be within their discretion.
That's not an option under the permanency guidelines. I mean, we have completely rehauled our child protection system over the past 20 years to ensure that we quickly make permanency determinations, because that is in the best interest of all children. So to suggest that a parent can appear at a TPR trial, raise hell, get removed, and then be rewarded by having the trial continued is not going to get any traction.
Mm-hmm. I understand, Your Honor, and I understand that's maybe not the best option in this scenario. However, the district court had other options. The district court is allowed to take testimony to conduct a hearing virtually or through remote technology under Rule, I believe it's 11.
And would we think Mother would have cooperated with that or would have had the facilities, the physical technology to do that?
And, Your Honor, we don't know necessarily on this record, because the court, she wasn't given the opportunity. In criminal proceedings, the defendant, if they are unruly, if they're disruptive, they generally, you know, even if they are excluded from the hearing, they generally have the option to join the proceedings again when they are ready to conduct themselves in a manner that
is... Is there anything in the record indicating that Mother at some point during the hearing sent word to the court that she wanted to return and that she would cooperate with the procedure and the rules of decorum?
I am not aware of that. My understanding based on the record is that she was removed from the building entirely, so she was not given that option. She was completely removed. And so she was not given that option to return to potentially even have the hearing over remote technology in another room where the district court would then have control over how the matter proceeded.
I mean, what I'm hearing you say, counsel, is that the district court has in its toolbox a number of discretionary options that it can choose based on the circumstances that are presented in a particular case.
That is correct.
But they're not required to exhaust all of those, are they?
They are not necessarily required to exhaust all of them, but I don't...
Any of them.
But I don't believe there was an attempt here.
And so what? I mean, these are all things that the district court can do, but I don't know... I mean, is there some authority that the district court is obligated to go step by step through all of these possible options before proceeding under circumstances that are presented, like in this case?
I do not have authority, because I believe this is an issue of first impression for the court. I don't know that there is other authority in the child protection context to rely on here, which is why I, again, am relying on the rules and notions of fundamental fairness.
Let me ask this, although I don't think this is a default, we have the default rule. Mm-hmm. So if mother had not shown up to the building, do you agree that the district court could have proceeded with a default trial and issued its TPR order?
I think
assuming the state proved by clear and convincing evidence that TPR was warranted.
Under those circumstances, I think that's fair under the rule. Rule 18 provides if a parent fails to appear,
so
you get to proceed in default.
It's almost worse to me if you have a parent who doesn't show up, or you have a parent who shows up, won't cooperate with security. It sounds like she snuck back in the building and into the courtroom, and then was combative and said, the only way I'm leaving here is in handcuffs, and eventually that's how she left. Why in those circumstances would we say, well, that person should be treated better than the person who didn't show up? If we agree that the person who didn't show up caused commotion, perhaps behave in a way that would further impact her child or her family, why does that person get a second day in court and the person who didn't show up doesn't? That policy wouldn't make any sense to me.
Your Honor, because she did show up. She made the effort to get to the court. She made the effort to get to the courtroom. In doing so, she invoked her rights. If a parent completely fails to show up, if they do not step foot in that courtroom, I think under Rule 18, it's fair to proceed in default. In this case...
I have a question. I'd like to explore your legal theory, which is due process, right? And you've argued in your briefs that Coates does not apply, right?
The four-part Coates analysis, I argue, does not apply.
But then, in the Coates opinion, there's also an alternative analysis applying the due process clause, right? Shouldn't we look to that that part of the opinion to set forth the due process test?
Your Honor, the Coates opinion is interesting in that due process was not raised by the parent in the trial court. This court, in my understanding, chose to address that issue as a due process issue, I believe, on notice grounds, if I'm remembering correctly. However, the opinion in the Supreme Court opinion does not fully address and fully flesh out.
It's even if it's alternative analysis, I understand. I'm wondering if, do you think it's dicta?
I would say yes.
So then a year later, the Supreme Court applied Coates in the LF opinion. 2002. I don't think either party cited it. But the question there was whether the proceeding was a sham or a hoax, or on the other hand, a real judicial proceeding, and the Supreme Court reasoned that district court conducted an evidentiary hearing, heard testimony, made a decision on the merits, you know, found that statutory grounds had been proved, therefore it satisfied. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the due process standard is found there in those two cases, Coates and LF, that it sets a pretty low bar and that the facts of this case are a lot like LF. Do you have any comments on that?
Your Honor, what I would say is right now, I think the Supreme Court is actually looking at those questions. We don't have an opinion yet from the Supreme Court, but there is a case, a default case, that is up at the Supreme Court right now, that is GAH and ST. A22, 1065, and 66.
Can you say that again, please? The numbers?
A22, 1065, I believe, and 1066. I believe it was a consolidated appeal. That one is currently up at the Supreme Court, where there is a due process question before the court in regards to a default. And the Supreme Court specifically asked the parties to address whether the harmless error analysis applies when there is a violation of a parent's due process rights. So I think that we need to take that into account, too, in considering how we analyze this case. And, Your Honor, I do see that my time is up.
Appears there are no more questions for you at this time, but I bet you'll have an opportunity to answer more questions later.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah. Counsel for respondent, you may approach and begin. Please introduce yourself and your client at the beginning of your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Britta Nicholson, and I am an Assistant Hennepin County Attorney in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I am appearing today on behalf of the respondent in this matter, who is the Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. At the crux of appellant's argument in this case is whether proceeding by default was contrary to Rule 18 of the Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure. The plain language of that rule states that if a parent fails to appear for a hearing after receiving proper notice, that then the court may receive evidence in support of the petition or reschedule the hearing. On appeal, appellant is advocating for a very narrow, literal interpretation of the phrase fails to appear that is not justified by the plain language of the rule. Appellant is adding in timing restrictions to the rule that do not appear on its face.
Counsel, do we need to get into all of that given the existence of a rule that says if a parent appears, misbehaves, parent can be removed and the trial can continue?
Your Honor, I do agree with your point that you made earlier that it is almost a distinction without a difference because at the end of the day, the court did follow a proper procedure, did reach the proper conclusion based on all of the evidence in the record. I'm just merely raising this argument since it was the crux of appellant's argument. And in addition, as Your Honor noted, the court did treat this as a default and proceed as if it were a default, which in my opinion, I do believe was the correct interpretation and application of the rule. But I do also agree with your argument that even if it wasn't, it should still be affirmed under Rule 38. Yeah. But and my,
I just think as somebody who served on the original commission who wrote these rules. I mean, when we wrote the default rule, we had in mind, parent doesn't show up. And I was a public defender for 13 years. Parents don't show up half the time. So, I mean, we have one rule that deals with that situation. Then it seems we have another rule that deals with the situation of the parent appears but can't control their behavior, is removed, and the trial goes forward. It just seems to me that we are better suited to apply the rule that precisely fits the fact pattern than to take a rule that doesn't precisely fit and engage in interpretation of terms to make it fit.
I agree. There, and it's basically two separate paths to reach the same destination. But I believe that the application of the failure to appear, I still do think fits in this case, especially when you consider the fact that after appellant was removed from the courtroom, they took a 10-minute recess. There was a complete break in the proceedings, and then the trial resumed. It was almost a second half of the trial, if you will.
And how do you address counsel's point is that the is a first impression that the district court should be undertaking some additional steps before proceeding without mom present. Do you want to comment on that advocacy today?
Just to clarify, are you referring to the argument that there should have been additional advisories before appellant was
excluded? No, that the district court could have proceeded by Zoom and had mom present on the Zoom or some other prophylactic procedure to at least have mom participating in the proceedings.
And, Your Honor, I think that the district court, as you pointed out earlier, does have wide discretion and flexibility with how to conduct the proceedings in their courtroom, especially when it comes to issues of courtroom management and decorum. So while proceeding by Zoom may have been an option for a different parent with different behaviors in a different setting, the court in this case was definitely not required to try to pursue a Zoom option as a prerequisite, as opposed to moving forward without the parent present or moving forward in default. And in this case, the record is abundantly clear that the appellant would not have complied with a Zoom proceeding. That would have required her to step into a different room, which she wasn't even willing to do. Her statements in the record are very clear that she would have to be forcibly removed from the courtroom, it would have to be in handcuffs, and that she wasn't going to go anywhere until the district court told her on the spot her rights were going to be terminated, something she said she'd been waiting for 14 months, and she was begging the district court to just terminate her rights so, in her words, she could just leave. So it is abundantly clear from the record that she would not have complied with peacefully being removed from the courtroom, going to a separate room, setting up a Zoom computer, and then behaving appropriately on the computer.
Does that record suggest she really wanted to participate in the defense of her case?
I don't believe that she was interested in defending her case, Your Honor. As noted in the language she was using, she was treating the termination of parental rights as a foregone conclusion. She was telling the district court, I know this is the decision you're going to make. I've been waiting 14 months for this. Just do it. Just say it. I have nothing to lose. She wasn't in there in her statements. She wasn't trying to convince the court otherwise that her rights should not be terminated. She wasn't saying, well, I've done my case plan, or I have a great relationship with my daughter, or I really love my daughter, or I can fix this in the reasonably foreseeable future. Those weren't the statements she was making to the district court. She was basically just asking the court to terminate her rights on the spot so that she could just leave.
And in her motion for a new trial, did she make a proffer regarding the evidence she would have presented had she been allowed to participate in the trial?
She did not, Your Honor. And as was discussed in some of our briefing with Coates, Your Honor is correct that there is a two-part analysis in Coates. There's the four-part test when a party is seeking relief from the default, and then there's a separate due process analysis about whether the default was appropriate. And in the post-trial briefing, appellant did ask for a new trial under the four-part Coates test, and one of those elements in the four-part Coates test is whether the appellant had a reasonable defense on the merits. And even when analyzing that test, the post-trial motion did not proffer any evidence to say that there was a reasonable defense on the merits. And in the court's order denying the post-trial motion, the court noted that the appellant failed to provide any evidence that there would have been a different outcome if she had been present or had been allowed to represent herself. And in this case, the evidence is abundantly clear based on the 88 exhibits, based on the testimony of the social worker and the guardian ad litem, and based on even the district court's own firsthand observation of appellant's behaviors and demeanor and unmanaged mental health. The record is so overwhelmingly clear in this case that even if the appellant had been able to become calm and sit in the courtroom and participate, the record is abundantly clear that a different outcome in this case would not have been reached. So for appellant to argue that there should have been a continuance of this trial to allow her to reappear is without basis and is quite contrary to the best interests of the child in this case, who had already been in out-of-home placement for 16 months and I believe was only about, was a very young child under the age of 10 as well. I would also like to touch on the argument that she was deprived of her due process rights. As I noted in my brief, appellant was not deprived of any rights in this case. She was not denied her rights. She had the opportunity to exercise all of her rights, for example, the right to counsel. She forfeited and waived that right. She fired her court-appointed attorney and then chose to represent herself in a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of the right to counsel. She also had the opportunity to present evidence and exercise her trial rights, but she chose not to. As evident from the...
Did she choose not to, or did she waive that right?
I think it was a combination of both. I do think it was a choice, because if you look at the transcript from the default proceedings, there were three deputies, there was the judge, appellant's grandmother was in the courtroom, and all of those parties were trying to calm her down and explain to her that a termination isn't a foregone conclusion. Even appellant's grandmother was saying that. You know, they want to hear from you. It's not over yet. The district court judge was very clear with her. You know, I want to hear your evidence. If you can calm down, we would love to have you in here. We would love to have you participate. And appellant's response was, no, I'm not going to calm down. I believe her words were, I can't come down when I'm this triggered. You're going to have to arrest me and lead me out of the courtroom. So she was presented with the opportunity, and she did verbally decline it. And then through her actions, she declined it as well. So basically, appellant's own choices and her actions, not the actions of the court, were the things that prevented her from exercising her trial rights. And she did receive the same due process as the parents in Coates and then also the LW case, which I cited in my brief, that the TPR in this case was based on the fact that it was proven by clear and convincing evidence with testimony of two witnesses and 88 exhibits that were thoroughly analyzed and discussed in a 41-page TPR order. This was not a TPR that was cursory and based purely on her failure to appear. It wasn't a sham or a pretense, as was discussed in Coates and LW. It was a real judicial proceeding. She was offered her due process rights to participate, which she forfeited and waived, and then she received the proper due process that is afforded under a default proceeding by having the decision being based on the evidence and not just being based on her failure to appear. I would also like to touch on something that was discussed in the briefs and then also briefly touched on during appellant's presentation this morning, which is the concept that overall, appellant in this case should not be allowed to benefit from her poor behavior. As Justice Larkin pointed out, it would be an absurd result to think that a parent who doesn't appear at all gets a worse treatment than a parent who appears and is obstructionist and is so disruptive to the proceedings that they have to be arrested. In addition, I made analogies in my brief to the criminal context, the concept of, for example, forfeiture by wrongdoing. In criminal cases, defendants have constitutional rights that are vested in them because there's a risk of a loss of liberty from those proceedings. And even in those cases, when their constitutional rights are attached, as opposed to the statutory rights in this case, they can forfeit those rights through their own bad behavior. For example, there's the forfeiture by wrongdoing exception, where if a criminal defendant engages in conduct that interferes with the availability of a witness, that they have sacrificed their Sixth Amendment right to confrontation. There's also examples from the child protection context. In child protection proceedings and as part of due process, parents have the right to service and notice. However, they can sacrifice and waive that right through their own bad conduct, such as refusing to accept a petition when it is offered to them, and also by evading service. So by analogy, I would urge that the same result should be reached in this case, that in this case, the appellant briefly appeared, but then she engaged in negative behavior that resulted in her removal and her lack of an appearance for the second half of the proceedings after that 10-minute recess. She should not be allowed to have the benefit of a continuance of further delaying permanency for her child purely because she appeared, sacrificed her rights, and engaged in extremely disruptive conduct. So for all of those reasons, I would ask that the district court's order be affirmed. I do see I have a little bit of time left, so I would be open to any questions.
As to your argument, do you think it's more forfeiture or waiver in terms of the due process rights that she lost by behaving this way?
I would say it is a combination of both. As I mentioned earlier, she was blatantly given the opportunity to stay if she was able to behave in a certain way, but she rejected that and I think thereby waived that opportunity.
But if we're talking about a waiver, don't we need findings that it was knowing and intelligent?
I believe so, Your Honor. So I think the waiver is more structured and literal. For example, what happened with her right to counsel in this case, where the court gave her many advisories, walked her through the process, all of those things. However, I do believe that the appellant in this case was very, very well aware of her trial rights and that she needed to be present and that the proceedings could move forward without her. For example, she was served with the termination petition, which came with a summons that explained what was at stake, what her trial rights were, and that they could proceed in her absence. There was also hearing notices that she received that had in all capital letters that if you fail to appear, the proceedings will continue, and including a termination of your parental rights as a possibility. And then I also noted while reading the first transcript from the admit-deny hearing, notably, appellant had to be removed from that hearing as well due to her disruptive behavior, that prior to removing her, the district court did warn her that, you know, you need to calm down, otherwise we're going to have you removed, and just so you know, if you're removed, this hearing will continue. So she was fully aware of her rights or what would happen if she continued to engage in negative behavior and was removed. And I think that is the crux of a waiver analysis, is whether they were fully informed of their rights and then made a conscious choice not to behave in accordance with those. So I do think a waiver analysis would still apply. However, I think forfeiture is probably more on point with the lines of case law saying that if a criminal defendant, or in this case a parent, engages in behavior that undermines the judicial proceedings, they then forfeit the benefit of those judicial proceedings.
I have another question about terminology. The district court, at least in one place, used the term default judgment, and I think that term, those two words, have appeared in the briefing too. Would you agree that that term is no longer apt? I mean, really, it's a default. Default judgment, I think, was entered in Coates based on the then existing rules, but the rules were amended. So there simply is a default situation, but it doesn't mean that the party automatically loses, you know, the case is concluded without the presentation of evidence under a default situation. The court still must proceed to receive evidence to have a factual basis for a decision on the merits. Correct?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I don't think default judgment is the correct terminology at this phase. That, I think, starts to harken back to civil proceedings where basically if a party fails to appear, a judgment is automatically entered against them. That's not something that we do in child protection proceedings. It's more of a default proceedings or a default procedure, and then it ultimately leads to a termination of parental rights. And that is...
The rule specifically provides that if petitioner proves petition by the necessary burden of proof, the court may enter judgment. The rule specifically says you have to have a trial.
You read my mind, Your Honor. I was just about
to say. I
wrote
that rule, so,
so you know it
because
very well.
Because this was being debated a million years ago, there were people at the table saying if parent doesn't show up, we just get our order and go home. And the agreement was, no, these are important rights. There should still be a presentation of evidence and an assessment of whether the result sought was established by the evidence and in the best interest of the child.
Correct. And there is definitely a possibility where the default proceedings happen. A court looks at all the evidence and says, I don't think this is enough, and declines to terminate parental rights. That wasn't what happened in this case. As I stated, the evidence was overwhelmingly clear that a termination was, there was a statutory basis for a termination, and it was in the best interest of the child. And the district court's order was 41 pages long. It was very detailed. It was very clear that the court gave this very close consideration and found that the evidence did support the termination, and it wasn't purely based on the fact that she failed to appear, or it wasn't, you know, retaliatory based on the fact that she engaged in poor behaviors. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nicholson. Ms. Warg, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Ms. Warg, could I just ask you to clarify before you start? As I read your brief, you're not arguing that the evidence was not sufficient to support the termination, with the exception of the adequacy of the district court's findings on best interest factors.
Yes, Your Honor. And that is actually one of the points I was going to make. I think we need to look closely at the best interest analysis in this case. Counsel argues that the evidence is sufficient to support the termination of parental rights. However, the paramount consideration is the best interest of the child. It's so important that a finding that the best interests are not served by the termination can preclude that termination. In this case, there was only a cursory best interest analysis. The court is required to balance three factors: the child's interest in preserving the parent-child relationship, the parent's interest in preserving that relationship, and then the child's competing interests. In this case, the court did make findings as to the child's competing interests. When it came to the interests of the parent and the interests of the child in preserving that relationship, it basically summarized the county's position that it had considered those and that it didn't find that it outweighed the competing interests of the child, and the court then said it agreed. The court's analysis in this way was deficient. It cannot uphold the termination of parental rights. I would also note that
I just want to be clear. So I'm looking at addendum 40 and 41, paragraphs 49 through 50.5. I mean, you know, that's a page and a half, almost 2 pages of discussion about the best interest factors, including the law and the evidence and so on. And you're saying that's insufficient to allow appellate review?
It's insufficient if you look at the substance of what the analysis is, Your Honor. I agree. It is about, you know, almost a page and a half here of analysis, but the court is required to balance three factors, and the court primarily speaks only of one, and that is the competing interests of the child. It does not take into account or make specific findings of the court as to the competing interests of the child and the competing interests of the parent. I would also submit that this is information that mother could have provided the court and likely would have provided the court had she been given an opportunity to testify at the hearing.
The court did receive quite a bit of information, though, about the relationship between the child and her mother, yes. Specifically, visitation, how visitation went, how it often did not go well for the child. A mother didn't appear for visitation, which also did not go well for the child. I mean, there's evidence in the record, and the district court did cite the three factors, yes?
The district court cited the three factors. The district court did not analyze the three factors. And even if there are, even if there is information within the record, the court does not make findings as to that information in this order.
Is the court required to make specific findings on each of the three prongs?
Your Honor, I believe it is under the most recent case law, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the case off the top of my head. I can certainly...
I know there's a case that I wrote that says if there's a TPR and the court did not make a best interest finding, we're going to send it back because we're not going to substitute our judgment for that of the district court. But in a case such as this one, where the district court referenced the three-part test, discussed one part significantly, and then made a best interest determination, which is consistent with all of the findings that are not challenged in this appeal, that is very different than not having a finding at all.
But the best interest is based on more than just what the district court finds as far as the statutory grounds. It's an independent determination where we have to look at these other competing interests.
What evidence, what, I mean, did mother make a proffer at her new trial motion stage saying, well, here's the evidence I would have presented to show that maintaining the parent-child relationship is in my child's best interest, and here's why. So what's that evidence? What would the district court have heard?
Your Honor, there was not a proffer. I believe mother could have offered information on that. Certainly, she could have spoken, she could have talked about her interest in preserving the child relationship. She also could have presumably talked about the interest the child had in...
How could mother talk about the interest the child had if she hadn't seen the child in months?
Your Honor, there were gaps in visitation, but she had had visitation with the child, and there were... It wasn't all negative. There were certainly positive moments in those visitation notes. And the district court failed to consider that in making the best interest determination.
And the child is placed with her maternal grandmother?
That is correct.
Okay. And is that placement become permanent, or is it held up by this proceeding?
It is. The department needs to continue making efforts toward that finalization of permanency, but it cannot... An adoption cannot proceed without...
But we have the child with maternal grandmother, and maternal grandmother was at the trial showing sympathy from mother, so there's...
No, that was the client's grandmother.
Grandmother, okay.
Yes, yes.
And is that who the child is placed with?
No.
Okay. Child is placed with whom?
With her grandmother. Client's grandmother was at the hearing.
Okay, so client's child is placed with your client's mother.
That is correct.
Okay, so it's a family placement.
That is correct. Yes, Your Honor. And I see my time has ended. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within the timeframes determined by statute or rule, and I believe in a case such as this, that's 45 days. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel in the second case.